Taxation number 21735, Rule 8.
Bob Shrimpton, Rule 8. So, are there any other effects with that fatigue? Are you...
Well, I think it upsets your pattern. I mean, you know, if you come to work it out, you, nowadays we go to bed 10:30, 11 o'clock at night, and you wake up 7:30, 8 o'clock. Then there, the pattern is completely different, and the body has to try to come to terms with that pattern of sitting in a chair with headphones on, watching a screen for 2 hours. Somebody comes and taps you on the shoulders, okay, I'll take over. You stand up, you're as stiff as a board, you're probably frozen, and you think, well, what am I going to do now? So you go down to the mess deck, and the first thing you want is a good hot cup of tea and a meal. That was always ready for you. And by the time you finish that, you're just beginning to nod off, and you suddenly think, God, I've got to go back on duty again. And so the body has to take over, or the mind has to take over the body and say, look, get up, drive yourself. And all the, once you get back onto your station and you've got your headphones on, okay, you're fine again. But you've got to go through that routine. The only time we did have a break was probably when the skipper would say, okay, you can lift the dome, close the exit cabinet down, if they knew they were in a safe area, or they were with other ships that were operating. Then we just go down to the mess deck and we just crash out. I mean, it's no good trying to sling a hammock, because we'd never get time to get into it. So you just flake it onto the head on the on the table, and you then sleep. And people would come down the off watch, and they would never ever try to disturb you. I think they realised what we'd been through, and so it worked out fine, because then probably they'd leave us undisturbed for 4 or 5 hours.
How would you, doing the 2 hours and 2 hours off, when it was your turn to do a watch, how would you rouse yourself from, if you'd fallen asleep?
I think it's mentally. I think your mind clicks into gear. Remember, in those positions, there's that element of danger all the time. And you feel that, in some respects, you are responsible for the safety of that ship. You keep your ears and your mind working. And so I think basically the body is an amazing piece of equipment, if you come to think of it, and so is the human brain, that if you've got into a regular pattern of doing this at a particular time, doing that at a particular time, it automatically does it. I mean, you go on watch, put your earphones on, sit down, start transmitting. You know instinctively you've got to do 2 hours of that, and the body and the mind switches to it. So it becomes a habit. It becomes a habit.
And obviously you're now actually out doing your ASDIC job for real. Did that differ from your training?
No, I don't think it did. Except, of course, that when you were doing your training, you weren't being threatened by anything. But I think, basically, what we were taught in the classrooms clicked together, and you adapted the equipment that you had to what you did in the classroom. And I think, basically, I think the training and what eventually you did was very, very close. It was very good. Very good indeed. Obviously, over the years, it expanded. The equipment became more upgraded, and the range was greater, and the equipment was so much more sophisticated, so it improved all the time. But then, of course, you had to keep up with it.
And on that first trip, what type of things did you pick up? Contacts did you make?
Oh, we picked up all the convoy noises, different engines, and one we did pick up late at night, coming from a different bearing, and it was one of the stragglers of the convoy got lost. I think it was some Portuguese ship or something. He'd got lost and it was coming in on the wrong bearing, and so the skipper would order us to turn around and chase back and guide the poor old boy into the right convoy lane, you know, because you see, the convoy was not just a line of ships, it was probably two or three lines of ships. And the Commodore, who was the officer in charge of the convoy, he was the man that had to keep the convoy speed at the speed of the slowest ship of that convoy. If he didn't do that, you can imagine a lot of the convoy, the slower members, would be dropped off at the end and they'd be trailing back miles and miles without no protection. So he had to control the speed. He'd know the speed of all these various ships. And then the convoy flotilla of destroyers would be on the outskirts, patrolling up and down, trying to act as watchdogs to try and keep them in. So we had to make sure that we knew where the convoy ships were, so that our transmissions didn't get interfered with. So if we were on the starboard side of the convoy, our range for echo sounding was from probably port 5 degrees to the port, right the way down to the starboard side. And we'd have to cover all that area to make sure there was no attack from this side. And the other screen would do the same for the port side of the convoy.
And at that time in 1942, if you had have made a contact, what would the procedure have been then from your point of view?
The immediate thing then would be that if the skipper was ordered by the flag officer to go in and attack, we'd have to try to bracket that submarine and keep recording it so they'd head towards it, and we'd have to keep track of it all the time and record the lowering, the distance of the range as it closed. Now, if you remember, when you heard it on some of these films, you hear that ping, whoop, ping, whoop. Now, when the ping and the echo comes together, you're over the top of the target. And that's when you hope that the skipper will say, depth charging. If he didn't say that, and you've got your earphones on, well, I did have a ruptured eardrum once from that, because the explosions in your earphones is tremendous. And if he said depth charging, you could quickly move your earphones so they were just on your temples, and it didn't affect your hearing. But if he forgot to say that, well, we used to have to try and guess that he was going to do that and quickly move them anyway. But so that was the idea, is to run over the target, drop the depth charges, and then we had to circle round, and our job then was to try to pick up whether the attack had gone home or whether there were any sort of Doppler noises or sounds of a U-boat breaking up or anything like this. But sometimes they would run deep and you couldn't pick it up. But we'd hover around that area for some time.
Doppler noise?
It's a fluttering noise, a Doppler noise you get underwater. It's like a bubbly noise, and that's usually the sound of, something breaking up or water rushing in or something like that.
Is there a point when the submarine would have been depth charged that you would have lost contact with the submarine?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes, you lose contact, because don't forget that the submarine's behind you. You're heading out to oversea. So then the skipper's got to turn around and head back. He can usually head back because he sees the home for where the depth charges went off. And we immediately have to start transmitting in that area to try to pick it up, tracking left to right. You've got to anticipate whether the submarine has gone port, or whether he's started going starboard, whether he's gone ahead, or whether he's run deep. So this is what the skipper's got to try and assess.
And really, I'm talking about that first period when you were doing those Arctic convoys. You'd done this training. Had you been given any training on, if you had made contact with the submarine, how it might try and evade you and what you would do to try and get back contact?
Yes, you had that. They used to use an area with little magnetic ships, and they'd have a submarine there, which is a game, and they'd move them round, and if you've lost contact with a submarine, then you have to start hunting 10 degrees to port, 10 degrees to starboard, right the way around, in an effort to try to pick up that target again. Sometimes a skipper would be pretty good. He, probably one of the old sorts, would know, and he would tell you what bearing to start transmitting on. You know, so it was a cat and mouse game, always has been, always will be.
And is there a certain amount of anticipation in your own role as to where you should be looking for?
Oh, yes, I think so, because if you remember, when you're transmitting to start with and you're running for it, you knew which heading that submarine was going on when you went in to attack it. Now, so you have to try to assess, well, if we missed it then and he's still travelling in that direction, we'll start from here and move back towards him. So you can use a bit of sense and a bit of ingenuity at times. No, but eventually we used to pick him up again. Yeah, eventually. We never actually sunk one, but it went ran deep. And but by then, of course, the convoy had gone. So there was no danger to the convoy.
Would you have attacked in conjunction with another destroyer?
Oh, yes. They always run in patterns. They always run in patterns. One would run over the target area for depth charges, and while he's run over it, the ASDIC operators on the other ship would have been on that bearing, and he could have picked the target up for him. So you work in conjunction. You hunt in pairs like that.
So I'm thinking back to the first convoy. Mm-hmm. You said you got to Bear Island.
Yeah, Bear Rock. Yeah.
Where was that roughly?
Northern part of Greenland, just before you go into the Straits of Murmansk. It's a bleak place. But there, we used to sort of circle around there to pick up a convoy coming in. Because those shipping lanes up there got pretty crowded. And so the thing was to hover out there, still hunting with your ASDIC, to make sure there's nothing following the convoy in. So that was the idea of blocking off that area. And, of course, the other thing was, in the height of the winter, those straits would freeze over, and so you could get trapped inside one of those. So that's why we kept it near Bear Rock.
And the Russian trawlers, you said, would take them into
the mouth? The Russian trawlers would come out, and they would escort the tankers and that sort of thing, and the merchant ships into Murmansk or Archangel.
What was kind of the relationship between the Royal Navy and the Russian Navy at that point?
Brilliant. Well, of course, that was a strange thing. In Murmansk and Archangel, all the stevedores on the docks were women. The men had all gone to the front. There's only one or two elderly men there. But, the Russians were obviously very grateful for what we did then. I mean, no, this thing is Cold War. I mean, that's all politics again. But basically, we were all doing the same job. We're all serving the same purpose, survival.
And you came back from the first convoy. Where did you come back into?
Came back into Scapa Flow. And then went back down to Rosyth. We then came back to Portsmouth. The reason for that is new equipment coming in. And I had a week down in Portsmouth doing an assessment on new sonar gear. And then they said, right, you're transferred. I said, where am I going now? They said, HMS Belfast. So I said, well, what is it? They said, it's a flagship of the second cruiser squadron. Oh, crikey. Brass and all that, gold rings, you know, I hadn't been used to all that. So they said, it's up in Scapa Flow. I said, I just come from there. They said, well, you've got to go back. So I spent a whole day travelling by train up to Thurso. I got out of the train there. I remember the train stopped in the middle of the high street. There was no platform. You just jumped down. Went to this town hall where there were a couple of Wrens there. Gave us a hot meal, two of us. I said, we've got to go by trawler to Scapa Flow. I said, well, the trawler's down at the harbour now. So we climbed on board the trawler. Set off, and the chap said, what ship are you going on? I said, HMS Belfast. He said, it's not a Scapa Flow. I said, do what? He said, it's not a Scapa Flow. I said, well, where is it? He said, in Rosyth. I said, we've just come from So anyway, he took us back after he'd done his deliveries to Kirkwall. We took this blessed train all the way back down to Edinburgh, and then we eventually picked up the Belfast at Ross Isle. And I walked aboard and met up, and there we had in command of the ASDIC section a petty officer, Bob Smith. He came from Winchester. I said, "You're a Hampshire boy. That suits me fine." We became great friends. And I went on to number 8 mess. And the important thing to remember when you're transferred to a ship, it's like moving to a new town as a youngster. What are the things you've got to do? First, you've got to find out where you live. Second, you've got to find out where the shops are, the butchers, the bakers, where the hospital is, or a doctor, or a dentist, where the church is. Now, Belfast is not just a ship with them great guns. It's a living town. 900 odd men on board. They've all got to live somewhere in their houses. Well, our house was the mess deck, number 8 mess. You knew where to sling your hammock. That was your bed. And that table and the chairs you sat on, that was your home. The men around you were your family. You had to know these things quickly. And the next thing you had to learn is, where is your action stations? Because it doesn't matter whether you've jet set sailed or not, or you've been at sea for a long time. Those sirens could go at any time. An air raid, a surface ship. You had to know exactly where you got to go and how quick it's going to take you to get there. And when you've got there, you've got to know, find out where all your equipment is. So that's what we virtually did on that first day aboard. Bob Smith came round with me. There's the bakery. There's the butchers. There's the machine shop, or the blacksmiths. There's the sick bay. Dentist is in there. There's the chapel. And then down all these flights of steps, I said, "Where are we going?" He said, "We're going to your action stations." I said, "What, down here?" He said, "Yep." He said, "The ASDIC cabinet's down on the bilge plates." I said, "Why haven't you got one on the bridge?" Well, he said, "We've got a monitor up there." He said, "But you've got action stations, it's down here." And I thought, crikey. And I'm trying to count the number of ladders I went down, the steps I went down, and I was trying to think, hey, I've got to get tremendously fit to get up and down these things. But the ASDIC cabinet was a bit claustrophobic to start with, because remember before, we'd always operated from the fresh air of the bridge. And I thought, well, at least I won't need to wear a duffel coat down here. But it was typical Royal Navy, very, very efficiently laid out, very clean. And that was it. That was my action stations. Now, the idea was that you had your watchkeeping duties, two at a time, if possible, or one at a time. And when you're off duty, you had to have another job to do. And so if you were a gunner, you'd be a turret gun sweeper or something like that. I was ASDIC, and so Bob Smith said, "Okay, you're ASDIC cabinet sweeper." In other words, when you're off watch, your job is down here, looking after the equipment, keeping it clean, and that sort of thing. When it came to action stations, it was Bob Smith, the petty officer, and myself would close up as the two experienced ASDIC operators. It was, Belfast was a very, very efficient ship, there's no doubt about it. The officers were tremendous. I mean, Bob Burnett, Admiral Burnett, Captain Parham, Commander Toswell, all those men were experienced naval officers with years of naval tradition. And they were very, very emphatic that the Belfast was going to be the tidiest and the smartest ship in that Navy. And by cracky, it was, too. There was never anything out of place. Every mess deck was absolutely spotless. It was a bit different to the French destroyer, I'm afraid. But it was a marvellous experience, As I say, learning to know where you live and what you do is something you've got to do that very first day you go aboard, because you don't know. I mean, we went aboard, I think I got aboard about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and I had to learn all this thing. We sailed before morning, so that was the important thing of knowing where you lived and what you had to do.
Can you describe the ship to me?
What, its displacement and its size, I think, well, as you know, the Belfast had a rough entry to the war. She struck a mine very early on, and it was touch and go whether they would scrap it or rebuild it. And what they virtually did was take it down to Portsmouth, and there they jacked it up, and they jacked the thing up on wedges of wood, so that the split through the hull closed together. Now, if you go down into one of the parts of the ship, forward of the turret, you'll see where there's some plating put on the inside of the ship, where they actually closed up the gap. Now, the outside, they put on a concrete and armour-plated waistcoat round it, which meant that although she was launched as a 10,000-tonne cruiser, when she sailed again, she was nearly 12,000 ton because of the extra weight. Now, the only difference that made was the fact that it rolled like a barrel. It didn't pitch up and down too much, but it rolled something horrible. And it took quite a lot of getting used to. But marvelous ship, wonderful firepower. At the moment, she's only got two... twin turrets, 4-inch turrets either side. When I went aboard, she had three four-inch turrets either side. We had the two Walrus aircraft for spotting duties. It was only later that some of this was, two of the turrets were taken away, and we were fitted out with pom-poms and Orlikans. This was mainly based because of aircraft attacks, and also prior to the Normandy landings, where we were expected to have quite a number of aircraft attack. But a very efficient ship, marvellous gunnery control too. I think some of the naval histories show that signals came in from the army commanders saying that they praised the accuracy of the gunnery at Normandy, trying to creep inland with a barrage, and how we could pinpoint targets, and they had quite a number of honours bestowed on it for its marvellous gunnery.
How many crew were on board?
I think when I was on there, I think it was about 920. It fluctuated a little bit, but that was the normal complement then.
What was her appearance?
Very smart. Mind you, of course, she was coated, she was painted in Arctic convoy colours then, because, and when you come to think of it, the artistic working out of how they do that, I mean, from a distance, it looked just like something floating through heavy seas. And because the two funnels were different colours, you couldn't tell it was one funnel or two funnels. Well, there was no funnels at all. Those wartime artists were absolutely brilliant at camouflage. Later on, of course, when we went out to the Pacific, that camouflage was altered. It went into light blue and darkest blue. I mean, but we, on Arctic convoys, it was those heavy colours, which they have still on board it now. That's it's been repainted in its Arctic convoy colours now. And I think it looks much more like the ship she was, the ship that I remember anyway.
Well, can you tell me something about the organisation of the ship?
Yeah, well, I think you've got to realise that having served on a destroyer, which was, I'm not going to say in discipline, but it was more slightly relaxed. We had a two-ring captain. The first officer was a sub-lieutenant. When you go aboard a cruiser, particularly if it's a flagship, it's a bit of a, what we call in the modern idiom, a culture shock. Here we have a ship that's got an admiral. It has a four-ring captain, a three-ring commander, a two-and-a-half-ring sub-lieutenant. You have a 2.5 ring surgeon on board. You have full lieutenants of nearly every division, whether it be after division, Stoker division, or Folkestone division. You have Royal Marines on board. You've got a Royal Marine band. I mean, when they're all assembled for Sunday divisions, there's what more scrambled egg, as we call it, the gold braid, on a Sunday morning you ever see in your life. And it's entirely different. But I will say this, that every man of that set-up, that hierarchy, were brilliant in their own job. I mean, we were extremely lucky. Admiral Burnett, Bob Burnett, the Barrent Sea, as he was nicknamed, was an incredible... this was a short man, but he was an incredible, friendly man to any rank, right down to Stoker Division, seaman. The captain was... Captain Parham was very, very efficient. Commander Toswell, the commander of a cruiser, virtually runs the ship. He is responsible for the crew. The admiral and the captain are responsible for the squadron and for tactics, but the commander runs the crew. And he was a very, very intelligent man, and he was a human man. And then underneath you had the various divisional officers, who was responsible for his own spokes of division or after division or whatever. Under him, you had the chief petty officers. And then on the folks of division, we had Chief Petty Officer Parker, which we used to call Grandad. I think he must have had about 20-odd years' service. He was a very, very strict disciplinarian. But if you had a problem, or he could see you had a problem, he would walk up to you and say, "Okay, son, can I help?" And this, I think, is the thing that ties the whole thing together. I think you've got to realise that a petty officer is virtually the same as equivalent to the army, a sergeant. And they always used to say the sergeants in the army ran the company or the regiment. They were the responsible for the men. And the petty officers were the same. We also had an air crew on board of Fleet Air Arm. Incredible young men, because if they put their lives at risk trying to fly those Walrus helicopters off, those Walrus aircraft off, and then hoping they might land close enough to the ship to be picked up. Just a small band. But it was a working machine. And the thing is, everybody was important. They all had to rely on one another. If I didn't do my job working as a submarine detector, their protection from underwater attack was gone. If a stoker didn't do his job properly, oil that particular part of the mechanism, an engine part could fail, problems. If a gunner didn't clean the guns properly, you had a failure. So everybody was integral throughout the crew.